Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey, everybody, this is Pascal. I have the incredible honor and privilege to talk to Rick Smith. Rick is a dear friend of ours. I know Rick for quite a while now. Rick is the founder and CEO of a company called Axon, and you might know Axon for its non-lethal stun gun, which is used by police forces around the world, called the Taser. The company actually was called Taser previously, but it is so much more than this. So think about body cams, think about a safe online platform to do evidence, really supporting the people on the front lines with modern day technology. So Rick, super excited to have you. I know that you've done a lot in the space of innovation disruption, really disrupting your industry. So super grateful for this conversation.
Awesome. I'm glad to be here. And stay tuned. The next couple of years, we've got some crazy awesome disruptive stuff coming. So what we have done historically pales in comparison to what's coming on the near-term horizon.
Okay, I'm at the edge of my seat. Let's start here. Let's start about the innovation and disruption horizon. And I'm really curious, and it's typically my first question, is how do you, as a practitioner, even think about innovation and disruption? Are these two different things for you? Is there a continuum? Is a spectrum? How do you approach this? How do you define it?
Yeah, so that's certainly interesting. I view them slightly differently. Innovation is the act of creatively solving problems in new and different ways. Disruption, I think, tends to have a little more of an aggressive tone to it, that you're innovating in a way that is specifically sort of disrupting an existing sort of space or industry, whereas innovation can be a little more blue ocean, where you might be doing something that's maybe not disrupting something that exists. But I think they're sort of a yin and yang. One is the general creative process, and the other is a little more competitively applying it, and shall we say, a little more of an aggressive way, where you may have incumbents that you will be disrupting with your new solution.
You've been in this game for a while, and your company has been very successful, truly disrupting from the ground up. How do you go about this? What is the magic formula for you? What makes it work?
Yeah, so I think a big part of this is we met through Singularity University. And I'd been running the Taser business for maybe 18 years or so. And we were feeling a little bit stale. And I saw a movie about Ray Kurzweil. And I turned to one of my lieutenants. I said, hey, we got to meet this guy. And we ended up learning about Singularity University and going to take some courses there. And it was really sort of enlightening for me to see this idea about exponential technologies and really not just thinking about innovation in a very local way in terms of how you can change your existing product, but stepping back and looking at, okay, what major trends are happening and which of those could come to my sector? And one of the great examples was the cloud. So in law enforcement, as we started creating body cameras back in 2008, we realized one of the biggest problems was going to be the back end, how you store all these videos. And turns out local city police departments really struggle with technology. And so we looked at what was happening in other industries. There was this big move to the cloud. Apple had already done it with the iTunes store in the consumer space. But in our business, it was interesting as we started to float this with customers, we got really strong pushback. They told us, nope, we can't do it. It's illegal. Evidence must be at the police department. We can't put it in some cloud thing. And so for us, it was just continue to dig in, try to rationalize this. Wait a minute, why is this working in the rest of the world? Why would it not work here? And the more we dug in past those customer objections, we realized they were really worried about security. Well, we would then just do sort of a first principles analysis. Well, can a local police department that maybe has 50 officers, maybe one IT person and zero information security experts, can they do their own information security more secure than we in partnership with someone like Microsoft or Amazon? And the answer comes back pretty immediately and blaringly, no, there's no way they could do it. They're thinking of security in a physical paradigm because historically they put on guns and they lock the door to the room and that's how they protect the drugs and the guns and the other evidence. In our case, digital evidence sitting on a laptop, but you could have hackers from China in that laptop and you would never know it if it's connected to a network. So what I would say is it was just this process of understanding why the customer is saying no and not accepting it. Now, sometimes customers, right, you certainly want to be very careful when you don't listen to them. But I think these disruptive opportunities come when you take a new path, and new paths always get no at the beginning. And so it's identifying which no's are the real no's where you're not going to win, and which no's is the customer just not aware of the future yet and that you could bring to them.
Something struck me here. I love the fact that you mentioned first principles thinking. It's a recurring theme on this podcast. We hear it from basically everybody tells me, oh, you need to go back to first principles. You need to talk to the customer. You really, really need to understand what they're actually doing, what they're after, what their concerns are. So overcoming customer objection is one side of the coin. Often what we'll find is, and I'm curious what your experience is, you also have the objection inside of your organization, right? Very often we like to talk about this idea of core edge. Very often you've got the existing business and then the new thing, which kind of threatens a little bit the existing business, and there's objection. Have you ever had to deal with that, or was that never a topic for...
Did we have to deal with it? So, all right. So we've created this company. We were a one-trick pony at first. We had done the taser weapon and it was quite successful, but it was quite controversial. People were getting... It was becoming so widespread in its use that people were worried, and there were many news stories. Are the police abusing people with the taser? How dangerous are they? And so we had this idea, well, rather than arguing about whether police are good or bad, let's record what they're doing, and then we can all watch the videos and really form an opinion. Sometimes they're going to do the right thing. Sometimes they may have done a bad thing. Now, as we were doing this, we had this realization that the real opportunity was to also put the data in the cloud so our customers wouldn't have to, you know, go solve all these technical problems to run a big data center. Now, in order to do that, that meant, and we did this organically. We were a weapon company starting a software and camera business. We had zero in-house expertise. So we were out greenfield hiring people to start the business up. And for the first 3 years, look, we made a ton of mistakes. I mean, to be honest, we actually built our own cloud. We bought $6 million worth of equipment, and then 6 months into it, had a catastrophe where we nearly lost all of our data due to a misconfiguration. And we ended up moving to the Amazon cloud, realizing we didn't need to run the infrastructure. And we almost had a catastrophe. So during all this, we're losing millions and millions of dollars, at some points, tens of millions of dollars. And then we're having to hire new types of people. So for example, I might have a taser sales rep who is bringing in $10, $15 million a year of revenue. And in that business, those people might make, call it $150,000. Then we're trying to stand up the software business and we're hiring software salespeople. Well, that is just a different, you know, price point. And so we're bringing people in, and because it's new, we had to guarantee their income, right? Because we had zero sales yet. And those people might be making over $300,000. Well, in a company where people talk, the existing business is looking at me saying, why in the hell are we doing this? Why is that guy making 300 grand and he sold zero? And I'm bringing in this money. Our stock price is down. We're losing money at this thing. Customers are telling us they it's illegal to put their data in the cloud. In 2012, at a company meeting, I asked for anonymous questions. The number one upvoted question was, when are we going to shut down this video and software business? So we had damn near a civil war. I mean, a lot of senior people ultimately left the company over the rift that was developing. So it was super painful. I'd say the internal battles were actually harder than the customer battles.
This comes down to leadership at the end of the day. And clearly, you are a very courageous leader. How much do you think this, at the end of the day, if you were to project this out to a different company, different leadership, et cetera, how much does this, at the end of the day, come down to the willingness of the CEO, of the person at the helm, ultimately to call the shot and take the risk?
Yeah, well, I certainly appreciate the compliment there. But I think it's, as much as I'd like to say it was me, from an ego perspective, I do think being a founder made a big difference in that if I was a professional CEO, I don't think I would have survived. It was dicey. Our shareholders were upset. We were losing a lot of money. And the criticisms were valid. In 2012, it was not clear we were going to successfully make this jump. And as I've learned, most companies who try it have. In our case, we were just so deep into it. And more importantly than the sunk cost, we just believed, look, every consumer has a cell phone. They're recording cops all the time. Police have got to have their own video, or they're going to be just helpless. People are editing videos and cutting and only showing the bad parts. So it really just came to a core belief that between what was happening in other industries, the cloud was sweeping through other industries, and consumer, the proliferation of smartphones with cameras, we just looked at those two trends and said, damn it, we're going to stick it out. And then about a year later, the Ferguson, Missouri incident happened. And suddenly every cop in America wanted to wear a body camera because they realized, I don't ever want to be the guy who shoots and kills someone without a video to corroborate why I did it. So it was maybe a little bit of courage, a lot of stubbornness, and then just a really strong core belief that we believed what we were doing was just fundamentally going to happen. It was just a matter of time.
You spoke a lot about the challenges you went through and the lessons you've learned. I'm curious if you take a little bit of an outsider's perspective and say, hey, here's the lessons I've learned. Here's the stuff I've seen either works particularly well, and I wish I would have known in the moment what I know today. Or here's a couple of things I just really realize now they're just deadly mistakes. You shouldn't do those. A list of those?
I don't know that I've got a list, but I've got a couple I can share.
Yeah.
Probably the most important thing I would say is, especially for entrepreneurs, there is no more important area you can focus your time than recruiting great people. Mm-hmm. And everybody says that, but during the first 15 years of my career, I viewed recruiting as like an administrative task I kind of had to do. I was much more interested in actually doing work, solving problems. And I got to a point where I was just completely overwhelmed. And luckily, I had a young employee named Luke Larson, who's now the president of the company, who really convinced me that I should a large portion of my time and focus onto recruiting. Because obviously you hire one person who's better than you at a certain task. Now you never have to do it again. And it's going to happen better. I mean, this is super obvious stuff, but most companies really don't get there. It's just hard because there's so many things that take your attention to think about recruiting as really being the most important thing that you do. Next, I would say, beware the lure of easy meetings, like, or things that get a great initial response. So for example, the product I've introduced that the best initial response was called the auto taser. We basically hooked up the taser to a steering wheel lock, like the old club that you'd put in your car, and you'd lock it on your steering wheel. And if somebody tried to take it off and they didn't have the remote, it would shock them. And we showed this at CES, at the Consumer Electronics Show, really is kind of a test to see how the concept resonated. And it went bonkers. I mean, we were on every newscast in America. We were one of the innovations of the show. It was insane how much interest there was in this. And so we were sure. And by the way, we were really struggling in our core business. So this was a bit of a Hail Mary. Hey, let's see if we can create another product that might sell easier. And that nearly bankrupted the company. Because it turns out what made it interesting for the media, it was a kind of freakish. It was one that was so different that, and somewhat controversial, it was newsworthy. But that was actually no indication anybody would ever buy it. And so we spent millions of dollars, bet the company on this thing. And I remember we had a national test with Pep Boys, the automotive chain, and their managers would tell us, this is the most exciting product we've ever had. People are bringing their friends in to see it. And I'd say, great. How many of you sold? Oh, well, we haven't sold any. But it's great because it's bringing people into the store. And after about a year and a half, we shut it down. And I actually thought the company was going to go out of business. We barely survived and went back to our core taser business. Now there, the first reaction is always no, but we have these underlying principles that in that case, for a police officer to avoid shooting and killing someone, that is without doubt an important and valuable thing. Like putting something that's going to shock a car thief is kind of, again, one was harder to sell the concept, but ultimately created real value. And the other got a lot of easy wins in the media. And I've seen a number of these where people will get overly excited about the initial reaction or that they get some press. And frequently to me, that's a red flag. It's like, oh, wait a minute, the press may be looking at this because it's telling you that this really doesn't make sense.
It resonates for me because there's the same or an analog in this whole world about the hype and the reality. Everybody gets super excited about whatever, robotics, AI, etc. And then there's a reality of actually deploying this. When you look at the reality, it's the boring stuff. It's like automated form, you know, that kind of thing.
Yep.
It makes companies millions of dollars. So it's fascinating to hear that. I'm curious, if you were in the hypothetical, if you were to do it again, in terms of disruption, how would you go about this?
Well, I would think the other is really solving a problem that is an important one. You would be passionate about solving, even if you went a decade and you made no money. If you could solve the problem and the money never came, would you still be proud? I think that's an important litmus test, because I've had friends who started businesses. When you start a business to make money, the chance of success, in my estimation, is just much lower. When you start a business because there's something you're passionate about and it's grabbed you by the heart and this is something you must go do. All the successful entrepreneurs I know typically come from that camp. Many of my classmates went out to Silicon Valley in the late 1990s when the internet bubble was going bonkers. And in the gold rush, they all got slaughtered. But some of my earlier friends had gone out because they were computer geeks and they just liked this stuff. And of course, they were very successful. So I think it's really first identifying what is the problem that is worth solving, even if you made no money solving it.
So we talked about talent, the role of leadership and the importance of making decisions which might not be popular, but you're convinced about. A recurring theme I hear in the conversations we're having is that very often in organizations which struggle with this whole innovation disruption problem, ego becomes the enemy. So this idea of leaders inside of the organization starting to protect their kingdoms, building moats around their businesses, etc., for many reasons. And one of the people on our podcast, Christina, attributed this ultimately to fear, human just being fearful. I'm curious, how do you think about this? How do you see this show up? How do you overcome?
So yeah, in my case, I would tell you it wasn't fear. I had this problem with ego, and I'll just tell you a story. So I told you before, there's times you don't listen to the customer, right? Like when they had this resistance to the cloud. But there's most times you should listen to them. Before we did the cloud thing, right before that, we had had two successful Taser launches in a row. Both were really successful. One because it was the first Taser was really effective. The next one, we made it so small you could carry it. And it struck me that the next natural progression was we had to get to a multi-shot device because all these Tasers just had one shot. And so I pushed the team to do a multi-shot device. And there were two options. There was a two-shot and a three. And I pushed them, we've got to push the envelope. This is our big move on this product. We're going to make the three-shot. And I remember we have some former police officers in our building. And they saw the prototypes. And they came to me and they said, Rick, this thing's too big. Like, cops are not going to want to wear it. And I said, no, you're not seeing the vision. Trust me, when it comes together, it's going to be beautiful. It's got this big color display. They'll give us more room on that. And so I plowed ahead with internal people telling me, raising the red flags. Now, back then, we were sort of the Steve Jobs school of thought, like we're going to invent these Tasers and then surprise the world with them to their delight. Well, the danger I learned there was by not getting voice of the customer in the product, we could make catastrophic mistakes. In this case, the product was too big. So when we finally launched it, everybody initially, oh yeah, this is great. It's three shots. But when cops would wear it, they would refuse to wear it. In fact, the Arizona State Police bought 1,000 of them and their union refused to wear them because they were so big. They said it was interfering with the seatbelts. It was causing them to sit funny and like in the vehicle, which was something I realized because I'm not a cop. I didn't listen to that criticism. And I've never had to wear all this stuff around my hips and get in and out of a car all day. Turns out that was a very real critique. And the product was a bomb. We probably had a $10 million disaster in that case because I was arrogant and I was thinking I knew better than the customer. So I think this is really one of those great balances. I've gotten it catastrophically wrong and I've gotten it dramatically right. And it's trying to figure out when should you listen to the customer. And so now, for example, every product we do, every physical product, every software product, we put dozens and dozens of people through testing. So we're testing every sub feature along the way. So I'd say 95% of the time we listen to customer. Then there's the 5% where you make your big move, like moving to the cloud or adding a feature. Like we added live video streaming to our current cameras. And a lot of customers told us, I don't know if I want to stream video live. I'll wear my body camera and we'll use it later. But as we just kept digging into the use cases, you can imagine all sorts of times, wait a minute. Like you're talking to a dispatcher over the radio and they're trying to figure out what's going on. Like if they could watch a live stream of the video. So that's one where it was a new change. Customers were telling us it was so new, they didn't think they'd use it. And we're in the middle of that one now. It hasn't completely taken off, but we're getting up to like a 30, 40% attach rate now where customers are subscribing for the live streaming service. So it's hard to find that balance, man. It's knowing if you get this one right, you're going to be successful. You get when to listen to the customer and when not to. Those are like the biggest decisions you have.
Rick, one thing which stands out to me is you very openly talk about, very candidly talk about the mistakes you made. First of all, I'd say that is not very common. Very few people have the gumshoe and the willingness to talk about the mistake. Are you, as a company, are you doing any kind of after-action reviews? Do you've got a practice? Because you seem to be very clear about we try things out, we fail, we are okay with failure, we learn from it. Is there a practice for you to codify that?
Well, certainly, we do after-actions in each part of the business if something goes wrong. I would say part of it is I probably wasn't this candid when we were failing and like the company was at risk. Like there you can't necessarily be as vulnerable. But now that we've had a certain amount of success, I think it actually helps to be vulnerable. It helps people connect with you more. When it's like, look, we're all human. Sometimes people will think I've got a better batting average than I do because of where I'm at now. And so I find sharing these stories also helps people not only connect with you, but helps them sort of realize, look, people aren't perfect. Like the people who've been successful are no better than you are. We're all pretty similar as human beings. It's really the biggest difference is taking the risk to go do it. And I think people hold themselves to too high a bar, thinking, well, I'm not good enough, or these other guys don't make mistakes. Like, I've got tons of battle scars, and I actually really enjoy kind of sharing them too. I think partially because a lot of folks don't. And again, I just find people connect with you more if you're human with them, and you kind of share, hey, we screwed up a lot along the way. It's worked out okay, but man, don't feel bad if you've made mistakes, because we've made some humdingers.
Rick, my last question for you. It's my slightly heretical question, and I'm just curious to get your perspective, which is, if you zoom out and you look at industry at large, what are the odds? What is the where's Rick in terms of the bull and the bear when it comes to, can other incumbents, not your company, other incumbents actually do this kind of work? Can they actually be disruptive?
I would say it's probably easier to be disruptive in new segments. Disrupting yourself is hard. And by the way, I would never in a million years want to be a professional CEO. You could not hire me to go run somebody else's business. That's especially in a larger business. It's just, you don't have enough degrees of freedom. Like the thing, when we went into body cameras, if it was a professional CEO running the business, I don't think he could have survived. Because I was a founder, you get a lot more rope, where people are like, well, they sort of assume it's his business. He or she started it. And they'll give you a lot more leeway. If you come into some big business and do this, it's going to be super risky. I mean, if you're disrupting the core, you're going to have to go through a transition of the whole economic model. Now, some folks have done it, and I hold them in very high regard, but it certainly is hard. And you know, I might advise those folks, go do a startup and go disrupt the big company. Might be easier than trying to make the elephant dance, as they say.
Rick, on that image, the dancing elephant, thank you so much for this conversation. I absolutely, absolutely loved the candid view you gave us in how you're thinking about innovation disruption. I love the learning from failure, being so open about sharing it, but also like the tenacity to move through it and not letting it beat you down and being upbeat about it. And my observation is you really appreciate the learning in there and the moving
through there. I would tell you, internally in the company, one of the things I worry about now, 2,000 person organization, $10 billion market cap. And one of the things I worry about is, do we fail enough? Mm-hmm. Is there too much risk aversion setting in? And I really push my team not to punish folks when they've had projects go sideways, and to hold up and even extol folks who've tried valiantly and failed, and make sure that we never make failure bad for your career. And if you're not learning, if it's kind of a stupid failure, so to speak, that's one thing. But if it's, hey, here's something we're going to try and it's risky and it doesn't work, we want to make sure that we're supporting those folks and rewarding that kind of behavior. So it's really easy in a big organization for people to just sit back and avoid risk taking. And that's death to a business, I think.
On those wise words, thank you so, so much. This was absolutely amazing. I love the conversation and the energy you brought. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Pascal. I had a great time.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. Also know that this is part of an effort of us writing a book about disruption. So keep your eyes and ears peeled towards that. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and just like this. There's some weird algorithm thing, which, you know, if you like it, they will like us. So do me a favor, do that. And if you've got any questions, any comments, anyone I should talk to, drop us an email. Easiest email address for me to reach it as P, just the letter P, at finet.com. With that being said, thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.